Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome to the GDF. We'll begin with introductions. My name is Baruch.
Peter.
Yeah.
Douglas.
Rick.
Justin.
Ari.
George.
Michael.
Howard.
Peter.
Bill.
Andre.
Bernard.
Kay.
Gary.
Harley.
David.
Mark. Peter.
Larry.
Mark.
Jerry.
Jack.
Paul.
Harley.
Jason.
Lee.
Dean.
Drew.
Dave.
Jim.
Steve.
Lee.
Paul.
Tom.
And I'm Lenny.
Are there any people here for the first time or second time? You could raise your hand. Welcome. Special welcome to you. Our speaker is today's Carol Newhouse. She studied insight meditation for more than 25 years and has been teaching for 15. Her teacher is Ruth Dennison, whose teacher is Ubah Kim of Burma. She also studied with Dr. Rina Sitar at CIIS, and Dr. Tim Finn in daily life practice. She's the founding teacher of the Lesbian Buddhist Sangha in Berkeley. And we welcome you warmly.
Thank you. Oh, it's nice to be back. Always feels so good to be here. For those of you who haven't met me before, I often refer to this as my brother Sangha because the Lesbian Sangha in Berkeley feels oddly similar to this one, and we've talked about that before a bit, so it's really nice to be here. Oftentimes, the kind of talk I do, for those of you who've heard me share before, is rather personal, and there'll be a little bit of that today, but what I try to do is bring what I'm going through, or what's important to me. You know, the Dharma is so vast, and there's so much. And this time I have really been delving into my meditation practice. You know, you return and return and return to this. And so I thought I would share this morning what sounds a little bit to me more like what they call pure Dharma or more orthodox Dharma or my understanding of mindfulness. You know, mindfulness is something that is kind of tossed around all the time. Oh, yeah, mindfulness practice, I do that, or whatever, you know, especially out here in California. And I don't mean to make light of it. I think it's wonderful that we've integrated that into our vocabulary, and people that aren't even practicing Buddhists kind of get it. They're supposed to pay attention to things, you know, and that's great. However, sometimes we may not always understand the intricacies of that practice, or maybe they haven't even been discussed with us, depending what our tradition is. My tradition is Vipassana or Theravada. Can I just see a show of hands of people that practice more like Vipassana people? So it's like a good half at least of you. Okay. It doesn't matter if you don't. But I just wanted to get an idea, because I'm going to be talking about the way that I was taught by Ruth Dennison and her teacher, Kim, very specifically about mindfulness practice in the sitting meditation, but also everything I say can be, you know, applied to daily life. And I'll keep trying to remind everybody about that. So the mystery of mindfulness hopefully will be unveiled to some degree. I hope. So it'll be a combination of what orthodoxy, or let's say that's too strong, what my teachers have repeatedly instructed me in, and my take on that. I'll discuss what I think of as the two meditation practices from the Vipassana tradition that you would encounter in a retreat. You might encounter them just, you know, in a morning like this if someone was guiding you a bit. But they're two distinct ways of using your mind and heart. And you'll always encounter them if you go on any of these 10-day retreats or even a weekend retreat, Spirit Rock or something like that. You should hear this. They may not use the Pali words for them. I'm not sure. Pali is the language of the Buddha, the religious language of the Buddha. So a lot of these words are in Pali. The first one is called Anapanasati. And that one is more like concentration practice. And the other one is Satipatthana, and that's theoretically pure mindfulness practice. So we'll be talking about how they work, their characteristics, their benefits. And I'll probably also mention, if I get to a clear comprehension, which is another typical kind of mindfulness, which is used more in daily life practice. And if we have time, I may talk about some of the typical obstacles that we encounter when we try to do these things. So that gives you an idea of where we'll be going. So as I said, there's two main factors to Vipassana sitting practice. And you will recognize some of this. Even if you're a Zen student or a Tibetan student, you'll recognize it. But I'm going to be talking the language of Vipassana. So the first one is concentration practice, Anapanasati. If you go on retreat, or even as I said, if you're doing a weekend, usually the teacher will try to get you focused. It's as simple as that. That's all it is. It's all that stuff about bring your mind back to the breath, right? Return to the object of your awareness. They may not use the word concentration because it's kind of a scary word. I don't know, to me it is anyway. It sounds harsh or hard or I have to concentrate on something, you know, and you get this striving thing going and can be a little awkward. And it can be frustrating also to think that you have to concentrate in a certain way and maybe you're not always able to do it. But the idea is that you actually get your mind to stay focused on an object. Now, you can imagine that that could be beneficial, right, in our lives in general. We're pretty distracted individuals. And I know that as you practice concentration or this kind of focusing on the breath, you become aware that you're distracted. Right? Isn't that usually what happens? It certainly happens to most people. And that's normal, and that's fine. And they teach you, well, it's fine. Just return, you know, and make a new beginning, usually the way it's put. And you can see why that is. Sometimes in Zen or some other traditions, there's not a whole explanation about why you're doing these things. And in Vipassana, there's usually more. And particularly in the teachers that I had, they kind of give it away. You know, it's kind of a thing in religion about what's secret and, you know, what the student's supposed to discover for themselves, you know, and what you're supposed to be suggested or even sometimes told to do. Right, so there's a big continuum, I think. Even within a tradition, teachers will present it differently. I'm the kind of girl that likes to know what's going on. And I think that's why I stayed with Vipassana, although I do have some Vajrayana practices and some of the things I do. I don't like secrets so much. You know, I like to know, why am I doing this? Why do you keep telling me to come back to my breath? I mean, you know, am I supposed to figure this out 20 years later? You know? And so there's answers to those questions, very specific answers, even in the suttas. The Buddha talked about this. But the obvious things are there. You know, if you do anything in Eastern religion, you see that the breath is a big deal, right? It's very central. It's always talked about. So that's the object they pick. And I don't have to tell you why. I'm sure you guys could give me some ideas. But because, obviously, it's available, right? Rich people, poor people. In the parking lot, anywhere you are, you have this ability to focus on an object. It's right there. You don't need a fancy altar. You don't need a whole lot of things. More esoteric reasons, of course, are there, right? The breath arises and falls. It's continuously giving and taking, right, and interchanging with its environment, with the universe. So what happens for some of us, as we sit with that over and over, we begin to realize that we're intimately connected, right, to all things. We're not just sitting there having our experience. We wouldn't be having any experience if, you know, if the breath wasn't doing this give and take with the air and with the environment. You know, this is a simplified version of some of the reasons why the impermanence, right? The give and the take, the rising and the falling that we constantly witness, right, in Anapanasati, kind of begins to mellow us a bit and make us a little more humble, perhaps. So that also produces, can produce, once we get focused, can produce a good feeling. I don't know if any of you have gotten there lately, but if you really are able to sit with an object, particularly the breath for a while, and just be with it and return to it and return to it, like some of us were probably doing, right, in the first half hour, what tends to happen after a while? We get calm, right? We get a little more centered, we get grounded, whatever words you want to use. We focus inward. And so some teachers call that calming or tranquility meditation. Anapanasati can be looked at that way. You can encounter this in many places, right? Even in New Age, you know, kind of things, they'll do this thing, focus in, ground in the body. So this is really very common and a wonderful thing. Vipassana really pushes it, and there's even some esoteric teachings that are involved in when you get very concentrated and what happens and the things that are revealed to you. But that's one particular path, and that is not, according to Vipassana or Theravada, mindfulness practice. It's sort of the prep, is the way I see it. It's your ability to stay where you want with your mind. You don't have to stay in, you know, for a long time on an object. This is just practice, right? But if you can do it, then you can choose to do it, right? When you want to. And there's the key, right? That's the most important thing. You know where your mind is. You can choose to keep there if you want to. And you can see that could be really helpful. So that's why they call it concentration practice. Second factor, this is where technically mindfulness really lives. Some people call it awareness. Satipatthana. The mind notices what is happening in the moment, moment to moment. It doesn't get forgetful. It keeps returning, right, and returning. Not to a specific object now necessarily, but to whatever, right? Whatever draws the attention. So this could be also in sitting practice after Anapanasati, and you've done breathing for a while. We may get a chance, I may ask you to practice this a little bit later. We'll see how the time goes. But you open up, and the instruction can be, or you can tell yourself, all right, I'm focused. Lay it on me. You know, and you allow whatever to arise. I mean, not that you're going to prevent anything anyway, but with the other one, some sadness or a difficult memory, pain in the leg or something might arise, and you say, I noticed that, but I'm going now to come back to the breath. You see, because you're practicing concentration, back to where I want. But then later on, it's a more open-hearted, open approach. And you just allow for what is. And as the things I just mentioned might come up for you and be strong, you know, and you can identify them, oh, I'm thinking about him again, you know. you might say, okay, all right, what is this? And bring, this is the key, bring the exact same kind of attention to this, right? So that's the kind of mindfulness that we talk about. Awareness practice, in generality, when people are talking about mindfulness. It's a powerful dynamic. And I think it has kind of a yin-yang quality. And I thought I would try to explain this a little bit, or at least tell you how I experience it. Say you're in sitting meditation and you have a pain in the body somewhere. If your concentration is pretty focused and you decide you'd like to go there and make an inquiry or investigate that, you bring your attention, say, to the pain in your back, especially since it's been very distracting, you know, and you need to be there with what is. And the mind can be rather assertive. You'll hear terms like penetrate into the sensation. Something like that. In other words, really go there. You don't have to like be aggressive about it, but you really allow the mind energy to be with that feeling. It also could be a general feeling in the body, like sadness or grief or something like that also. A vibrational feeling, and you just, okay, I'm sinking into it, I'm penetrating into the quality of this feeling. Put it that way. The mind leaps forward into the object. It's even been described as it covers it. You cover it with your attention. So this is a pretty developed attention, right? Also, there's a more yin quality to this. And I haven't mentioned this too much yet, but as you're alert and as you're focused, say, on a sensation, if you want, there has to be the receptivity. There has to be open-heartedness. And this is where the other wing of the Dharma applies itself, which is a caring, depends on what word works for you. It could be a caring softness about the experience. It could be just kind of an interest, a neutral kind of interest. Oh, what is this? You know? Non-judgmental, right? Non-projecting, you know, all your fears on it. Oh, this pain, you know, oh, I know what this is. Oh, yeah, this isn't going to go away. This reminds me of arthritis. I think that, you know, my father had arthritis, I had arthritis. You know, you don't do any of that. You're there and you're alert to it, but at the same time, there's a, oh, it's okay. You know, let's just not judge it. Let's not worry about it. Let's just even bring it a little kindness. And see what? Okay, what's the purpose of all this? Now that's another question that sometimes doesn't get discussed. The purpose is in Vipassana, insight, okay, or knowledge, true knowledge, true insight. You'll hear it referred to as insight meditation sometimes. Okay, that's where that comes from. So as you're applying this kind of alert, focused attention that also has an open-heartedness to it, it is said, and maybe you have had some of these experiences, that insight occurs. That's a really good thing. Because there's a lot of things that we're concerned about and we don't understand or we worry about or we want in our lives. And if we can understand more deeply what's happening to us and the nature of our reality, we're happier human beings. You know, we're more peaceful. Insight meditation has an answer also for what the insight really is that you get. It doesn't tell you the answer to every single moment that you're investigating, you know. That's what you have to figure out. That's your own inquiry. But it does say what the Buddha found out, right? And in broad terms, this is what you're going to find out in your own way. And it's the characteristics of your existence. Right? It's these three things. This is again Theravada Buddhism. But the three characteristics of your existence that apply, they would say, to every one of these little inquiries that you're concerned about. Okay. And many of you have probably heard these, so I'll just mention them briefly. But there's three of them. They call them, I like this, the marks of existence. So the three marks of our existence. And the first one is in Nietzsche, which is impermanence, which is what you hear all the time in Dharma centers, particularly in the Theravada, particularly my teacher. You'll find that Buddhist teachers tend to gravitate, I think, to one of these three. This is kind of a side issue, but it's interesting if you want to speculate, if you've been around for a while, is this an impermanence teacher? You know, mine was, because she changed everything all the time. You know, she had kind of crazy wisdom, you know, and she'd say, we're going to sit from 10 to 10:30, and at 10:15 her dogs would enter the zendo, you know, and make a commotion, you know, and she expected everyone to just be sitting and realize this was impermanent, things had changed, you know, that kind of thing. And weren't they cute little dogs, you know? So you will gain insight into change and impermanence, and that's a healing thing. You will gain insight into dukkha or suffering. There's some teachers that are big on that. Mine wasn't so much, but and that wasn't really my path. But there are some that have, I think, extreme ability to understand, tolerate, and almost look for suffering in a way, which is a wonderful thing. Like people who work, you know, with dying people, people who work to engage Buddhism, you know, in wartime countries. I mean, people who put themselves in a situation that they're going to, dukkha's going to just be in their face even more than it is for us on everyday level. So you gain deep understanding and compassion probably through that. And the other characteristic that you will notice, which I think for Westerners is the most difficult, is no self or selflessness, which is a little bit easier to tolerate. Mm-hmm. My teacher used to say no solid self. That was helpful. It's like, well, okay, I do exist. You know, I'm just not solid. Okay. You know. And so you could see, perhaps, from exploring a feeling you had in the way that I said with this kind of concentrated and yet open-hearted mindfulness, that you might begin to gain insight into that, say, feeling of grief or sadness that might relate to some of those things I just said, suffering, impermanence, or even selflessness. Right? And these are the teachings that are given, but also given to you to experience. Experience, because as I think you all know, the Dharma is rooted in experience. It's not rooted in the Bible or, you know, even the suttas, although they're important. It's your experience, right, that matters. I'll talk a little bit about clear comprehension. It's another level of mindfulness. If you practice sitting meditation, there's one of my teachers that say you don't even have to sit to do this. My personal experience is without sitting, it's much harder to be mindful in daily life. But then again, I was trained by a sitting teacher. You know, Dr. Tintin in Sebastopol, she teaches daily life practice without sitting meditation. You know, and she uses exactly what I said. She's Theravada, all those things. But she applies them to daily life practice. She's excellent at this, by the way. The best I've ever seen. So if you're interested in that, I can tell you how to reach her. But she's on the web. It's wonderful. But all the Theravada teachers do talk about clear comprehension, and they say that the sitting practice helps you with this. And basically that's just being present. This is a little closer to Zen, actually, I think. In daily life activities. You know, so you have your chop wood, carry water, you know, Zen phrase. In other words, you're aware when you're chopping water, you're aware when you're carrying wood, you're aware when you're driving your car. You know, you're aware, I'm just seeing a vision of putting my BART card into the machine and grabbing it. You know, I'm taking my BART card. You know, because there's a sensation, you know, how you pick up that card, whoop, like that. And that grounds me sometimes, you know. Certainly, walking meditation, for those of you who've done that, is an example of this, right? Because you're moving. They don't really say this, but I think that's clear to clear comprehension. And what clear comprehension is a knowing of what you're doing. It's comprehending the situation, okay? Not dreaming again, it's the same thing. I mean, you're allowed to think about something else, but then you come back again. Oh, yeah, I'm in the BART, and, you know, I see people, and I feel a chair, and, you know, now I'm getting up, and, I mean, it sounds very simple, but I don't think we do this very much, right? And it's very grounding, it's very healthy. It also makes you safer, right? I mean, physically, you know where you are, you know, you're in your body. There's a lot of benefits. But I can give you a deeper experience quickly. So I have a little zendo in my backyard. It's a yurt. I don't know if you know, a roundhouse. And I've planted things, and it hasn't been raining lately. And, you know, I have to do more and more watering out there. And the other day I was looking out, and they were calling me, you know. And I really didn't want to go and water, but I did. And I just slipped into this practice where it was, watering plants, I see. I hear. First, I'm very tuned to hearing. So hearing sensation of the water. Well, that's a pleasant sensation. Well, that's another one. If you get pleasant sensations, that's really good because they hold you better. You notice that? We like the pleasant. You know, so that I think that's what got me. The nice water dripping and everything. I know what I'm doing. Hearing the water, and isn't that nice? You know, and then I was able to carry it on. I really looked at the plant. And I swear it looked like that plant was happier. I mean, I don't know if she really was, but felt like it, you know, perked up. And so through that experience of knowing, and then thinking about other things, but then knowing, feeling my feet on the ground, insight occurred. You know, I fell into some of the things I was talking about earlier. Oh, yeah, interdependence. You know, these plants wouldn't be here without me. But on a deep level, not just, yeah, I'm watering the plants, that's good. No, but more, you know, wow, you know, this is, we really count on each other, you know, and I need those plants because I want the place to look nice, you know. So they're doing me a service, I'm doing them a service, I mean, all this. So after you practice for a while, Dharma thought, is what they call it, kind of comes up. And it's very nurturing and very supportive, I find. And impermanence, of course, you know, that the plants will be here for a while. But, you know, it's fall and they're looking a little crisp. You know, I don't know how much longer they'll be here, but they will hopefully return, if we all do return, you know, in the spring. Just the amazing pieces of all that. If there's one person that I would recommend, Joseph Goldstein. I don't know if you've heard of him. He was one of the original guys who went over with Jack Kornfield and other Vipassana teachers to Burma, probably in the late 60s, I guess it was, to get enlightened or something. You know, Ram Dass, those people. And he found Burma, and he found Ubah Khin and other teachers, and Ruth Dennison was one of them too, my root teacher. And when he came back, he wrote this little book called The Experience of Insight. And for people that are interested in the Theravada Vipassana mindfulness theory and practice, there's nothing like this book. It's old. It probably has a different cover. It's small. And he wraps it down in little paragraphs all about what this is about. I'm talking about this morning and why it's important. And he does a beautiful job. Beautiful job. He still teaches around. You'll hear about him. He's a lot on the East Coast. He has a poem in here by a Zen nun. And I think it illustrates the kind of awareness practice, mindfulness practice that I was trying to explain to you in a poetic way. This ability to be alert and present and focused, concentrated somewhat, and also very receptive and open. 66 times have these eyes beheld the changing scenes of autumn. I've said enough about moonlight, ask me no more. Only listen to the voices of pines and cedars when no wind stirs. Only listen to the voices of pines and cedars when no wind stirs. So can you get a feeling for that? This person, this nun, is so present and concentrated. She knows where she is, right? And the moon is all very pretty and kind of romantic and lovely and all that. But as she focuses into the trees, she's so receptive that they can speak to her, that she can hear those trees when no wind stirs. Now, whatever that really means exactly, I'm not sure whether she has a voice of the trees or sound or perhaps an intuitive insight into tree, you know, or maybe an interconnected experience. I'm not sure. But that's what we're talking about, that kind of awareness practice. When mindfulness and concentration are both developed, a balance of mind is achieved and a fine, profound listening occurs. A deep and penetrating awareness develops and reveals many aspects of who we really are. And the aspects of who we really are the three marks of your existence. The Dharma is really beautiful. You know, the way it interconnects like that and teaches us. according to me, we have about 25 minutes left. What I would like to do is to talk a little bit, I'll do this very briefly because this is a whole other talk, of what the traditional obstacles are to this kind of awareness and what gets in our way. And then I have another idea. So we'll see how we do. Again, people who may practice in Vipassana tradition have heard this before. But if you haven't heard it in this orthodox way, you've probably picked it up in other places as well. Because these are very common factors that disturb our minds or disturb our ability to be mindful and be present. Five factors, five hindrances. Number one, wanting mind, craving mind. Right? I want this, I don't want that, I want this, I need this, I have to have that. There's nothing wrong with wanting something, but when we become a little obsessed about it, right, a little attached to it, we can't let go, boom, we're off balance. We don't know what we're doing anymore. The opposite of it, the second hindrance or problem is the not wanting, right? Pushing things away that we don't like. Understandable. Right? Of course, why wouldn't you push something away that's unpleasant? I mean, that's a knee-jerk reaction. But when we notice a knee-jerk reaction, what do? We either let go of it, or we bring kindness to the suffering that we're having because we're being exposed by something we don't like. We don't keep fighting. Right? Because you could see in meditation how that wouldn't work out. The other two are interesting. There's a couple that are sort of partners to each other. There's something called sloth and torpor. You know, that just means kind of sluggishness, you know, if mind and body. And again, there's no judgment about this. You know, you can be tired, you know. Well, then if you're really tired in meditation, maybe you should rest, you know. Or people do say some antidotes for that. You know, or to sit with your eyes open for a while. That works for me really well. But it's okay. It's just to notice that if I'm really sluggish in my mind or my body, it's probably not going to work so well. So I need to take care of myself. And then restlessness. This is the big one. This was my major hindrance. It always is. And I think it's part of our culture. You know, I just think we're restless people. We're taught to do a lot of things all the time. Multitasking. You know, and meditation is really not about that. You know? So we get anxious, we get restless. It's hard. But that's why the concentration practice is so helpful, because it really pulls us in and relaxes us. And the last hindrance is the most difficult to speak about because it's misunderstood, I think, by us Westerners. It's called doubt. And right away, the mind, the Western mind, roars up and says, "Wow, I don't believe everything I hear." Of course not. We're not talking about that, right? We're talking about the kind of doubt that's conditioned doubt. It's non-thinking doubt. It's just, "I don't believe that." You know, it's kind of my New York cynicism that I grew up with. I don't know how many of you are from the East Coast, and I don't want to offend anybody, but... But we were taught to be smart people, boy, and, you know, knock an argument down, you know, and get in people's face a bit about stuff. And to this day, I have a little trouble holding myself back sometimes. So it's that kind of conditioned doubt, you know, thinking we know a lot and not being willing to even open up and just relax, you know, and hear something new. It's a knee-jerk, what is that? You know, maybe because the language is different or something. You know, and that can really get in our way too. Right? We're not talking about just blind faith, opening up to things just because, not at all. You know, the Dharma's not about that, but it's a balance. If you have an experience and it's good and it feels healthy to you within, let's say in this case, the Dharma, you trust it, right? That's where your trust comes from, and you build faith, and that is Dharmic faith, faith based on your own experience. So don't get too caught up in doubting everything. Okay. I would like to, if you have the energy for it still this morning, take 5 minutes and try to guide you through what I would call sort of a typical Anapanasati mindfulness meditation. Because after I've said some of these things, you might be able to see it a little clearer why people are asking you to do these things. You know, and your mind might be a little more alert to it. Who knows? Would you be willing to try that?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Might be a little longer than 5 minutes. 7. So a lot of words. I've been using a lot of words. So see if we can just come back to the feeling of the cushion. This man's body sitting, just sitting. See if you can relax into just that. And as you do that, you may become aware of the breath moving in the body. Wherever you feel the sensation of that breath, that movement, it could be in the chest rising and falling, it could be in the abdomen. For some of us, it could even be more easily felt at the tip of the nose, where the air enters and leaves the body, you know, the upper lip right there. Wherever you can just notice that sensation of the breath, the feeling of it. Just bring your attention there. So this is the first thing that I spoke of, Anapanasati, breathing meditation. And the instruction often given is, if you're distracted from the feeling of the breath, if you notice that the mind has gone off and into thoughts, maybe an emotional feeling or even something else in the body, notice that. It's okay. Nothing wrong with that. Happens all the time. But then return. Gently make a new beginning. Allow for the feeling of the breath again, that sensation, and bring your attention there. Rest there. At this point, you allow the breath to really be the center of the meditation. And then at some point you may decide, or a teacher may give the instruction. You may notice that you're distracted from the breath, or you just may notice that there's something else in the sitting that's strong that tends to predominate your awareness. If there is, you can be with that sensation. It could be a feeling in the body, a different one, say pain, like I said earlier, or even a pleasant feeling. It could be more of an emotional nature. You tend to notice that you're really feeling kind of generally a certain way, a mind state, a kind of happiness, or tranquility. Sometimes, as I said earlier, a sadness, a frustration. Whatever else becomes predominant and available to you, bring that same attention, open-hearted, soft attention, to this new object, whatever else arises. It may remain strong, it may fade away, it may change, something else may predominate the meditation, and then you just shift to that, moment to moment to moment. Over and over again, becoming aware of what is predominant. Seeing what happens to it as you bring your awareness there. Becoming intimate with it. And then, if helpful, coming back to the breath, if you like. Just waiting to see what's next. Seeing if you can receive the messages from your mind and heart with openness. Just be aware that we're coming to the end of this experience, and bring your attention back to the body and the cushion. And then when you're ready, let the eyelids perhaps raise themselves and let the light of the room flow back into your consciousness. Well, heck, that wasn't too much too fast. Usually that's for 45 minutes. But since I tried to so much to, you know, get that differentiation of what the mind's really doing and why, I thought we could at least try. Anything anyone wants to share? Is this time for questions? Yes. Can you say your name, sir?
My name is David.
Hi, Dave.
I'm wondering whether you can relate from your personal experience. I had an experience recently in my daily life. I'm kind of going around, I'm meditating, going to groups, and feeling, trying to be mindful, and everything's going all right. And then I get thrown into a very difficult family situation where I have to be there for 3-4 weeks, and every attachment and people upset, and an endless amount of tasks that you can't possibly get done. And I found myself very off balance very quickly. And I was trying to think, okay, what can I do? And I was thinking, you know, if I meditate for a half hour, my mind was saying it's not going to put a dent. The feeling was, I got to get more things off the list. I got to try not to get upset with people.
Right.
And I'm just wondering from your own personal experience, when you're in those kind of situations, what you do. I have to go back, and I don't want to be in a different frame of mind
right.
next time.
Well, the first thing I would say is bring compassion to myself, because that's what drives me the most, is my own need to be good and to do it right and to accomplish a whole lot and to help everybody, or even if they're irritating, because in that kind of situation you feel like you just want to facilitate things, and to try to be gentle with myself. That's the first thing I have to remember. To not be tricked by the idea that a half an hour or even 15 minutes of meditation isn't going to do any good. That's a trick, you know, of the mind. And it does do good, and it does help, but it's hard to do it, not only circumstantially. It's also, I find, when you're in any stressful situation, it's the most difficult time to get on the cushion, right? It's always that way for me. And I think you could think of it just almost as physics or something. If the body is striving, it doesn't want to stop, right? It's a condition wheel, that's all. You know, it's going, and that's what it's supposed to do. And it has thoughts feeding it that it should. And it's very hard to, it almost feels like you have to yank yourself, isn't it, away from that and sit, or at least do walking or something. And in the first few minutes, it's painful. That's my experience. Now, I've done this so much that if I get into this position, I only have a minute of resistance, very fast, because now I'm so conditioned. But I have to get there. But if I get there, I would say within even 30 seconds sometimes I get that wish, oh, thank you. You know what I mean? Like, what were you thinking? You know, or something like that, you know? But I have to get there. I can't do it away from there. Even across the room, that won't work. I have to be in the position, you know, for me physically. But that's because I've conditioned myself to this position, you know? So if you have conditioned yourself, reconditioned yourself to walking meditation particularly, or yoga, or whatever it is, you know, whatever your main thing is, and that's the strongest, and that will work the best, I think. But you have to get there. How are you going to do it otherwise? You know, so there's no magic thing except to just reinforce all your thoughts are correct. It will help, and you'll be amazed, probably, actually, how much it does help. Does anybody else have any advice for this? Because we're all in these situations. If it's not family, it's other triggering kind of things. Is there anything else you would add? Yeah, Jim?
Yeah, I just add on to the family. We have to deal with difficult siblings around their mother's death. And the only time she had was when she went to the bathroom.
Yes.
She meditated on the toilet. Every time she sat down, she meditated. And it helped.
Well, they don't give you any privacy.
No, they don't.
You know, no. At least my family doesn't. But, you know, there's always outside, depending on where you are, or if you go to fill up the gas in the car, you could walk around the block. I mean, there was things you can think of doing if you really think about it, you know. Because if you go tell them you're going to meditate, then you have to hear that. I don't know. Anybody else have any wisdom on this one?
Well, what do you think about trying to have some insight into what the attachments are and why you're having those bad, overwhelming...
You mean in the interactions in the moment with these people?
Yeah, in the moment. What's going on here that I feel so crazed?
You'd have to answer that question for yourself. If I can have Dharma thoughts about it, like the ones I was talking about earlier, like dukkha, that would be the main one that would come up for me. Oh, yes. Not only is my mother dying and physically suffering and everyone else being totally inappropriate with the situation, making it 10 times worse, they don't like me besides, you know. And so now I have a lot of dukkha. But didn't the Buddha say that dukkha is unavoidable? You know, didn't they say that's part of our life situation? And it comes in different forms. And isn't that what I'm experiencing? Now, maybe that doesn't help you because it sounds a little intellectual, but I've thought about this so much that once I get that awareness on that level, not just that they're pain, but that this is a universal thing, you know. And you just all nodded when he was talking, so we've all had these issues. So then I'm in a community again, right? I'm not alone with these nuts, you know. I'm actually having a spiritual moment, right? I'm interconnected with the dukkha of the world, and it's just showing its face in this particular way. That kind of thought helps me. The thoughts that don't help me are the more psychological ones that I think you might have been referring to, like, you know, my father, he says this all the time, and it's because when I was 5 years old, you know, I didn't do this, or because I'm gay, or because whatever. That might all be true, you know, but it doesn't help me in those moments. That's all I can say, because it gets me going, you know. And if I had done this, and he had done that, and now my sister, you know, of course, she's going to get everything, which she did. Which she did in my family. She did. Which is another talk. Because I know exactly what you're talking about, and it sometimes does not get better, it gets worse. You know, a lot of anger, a lot of resentment, all that stuff. But what really helps me, as I'm saying, really having the faith and the experiential faith in these concepts and seeing them in operation and naming them for what they are and depersonalizing them. Yeah. Dukkha, what was I expecting? You know, to be different? No. It wasn't before. It could get better because it's impermanent. It could get worse because it's impermanent. You know, so I don't know if that's helpful, but that's how I use it. Yes?
So maybe just one more question.
Oh, quick.
Okay, yeah, I'm Justin. I'll say really quickly, hi, David. I had two Dharma-related thoughts to these family situations. One is about karma, that, you know, we see these conditions arising that create these circumstances, and if you can see it impersonally, that helps me.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is skillful, compassionate action.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have found with my family, and my family is fundamentalist Christian, I have found that if I told them I need some quiet now, they understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say I'm praying because I'm not. I thought about saying that, but I just said I need a little quiet.
Mm-hmm.
They get it because I'm coming from a centered, loving place.
Yeah.
So.
If you can connect with something that means something to them,
yeah.
It's not always easy. But that's a good hint.
Yeah.
One more, somebody over here?
Yeah, just in circumstances where I'm inundated with enormous expectations and responsibilities, I really try to just stay with what's in the moment.
Yeah,
and now
just
work with that and then let go of all the rest. And I have a belief that it will all fall in the right time.
Mm-hmm.
But I really screw myself up when I'm invested in all of the expectations that I want to achieve or someone else wants me to achieve. And what really gets me grounded is being in the moment, just paying attention and have compassion to
mm-hmm.
what's right in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Right, and for yourself too, because these are hard situations for us in many, you know, for many reasons. You know, I have talked about what happened in my family, and it was still happening, before here, or alluded to it, and I'm thinking maybe when I come back I'll actually do it. I'll do the thing from a Dharma perspective again. I mean, I don't want to bore people. But it seems like it's so present, this stuff, you know. So maybe I will. Be good for me. Thank you very much. Yeah, you hold me.
So are there any announcements?
I'll announce. My name is Ari. Oh, sorry, Dan. And on Tuesday evenings at 7:30, there is a group that gathers to meditate, usually at Darren Little's house. If you're interested, come see me afterwards.
Hi, I'm Jack. We're mailing out our great bi-monthly newsletter today, and I'd like to ask for a few more people than usual, maybe a dozen, show of hands, because we're, in addition to the newsletter, we're trying to cull the prisoner mailing list, which is about two-thirds of the over 300 physical copies that we send out, and you have extra inserts and postcards and things like that. So if you can stay, we do it right after team cookie, 10 or so minutes after, and if you could help, then you can make life work. That would be great. Hands, please, just to help.
Jack, I wonder if you got the announcement we have to be out of here early.
It's next week.
No,
it's
that next week. Yeah. Never mind.
But everyone help us remember, next week we have to be out by 1:45.
I didn't see a dozen people actually help. No? Thank you.
Wes. I'm Michael, and the GBF annual retreat is coming up October 12th through the 14th. The registration deadline is Monday, October the 8th, which means you would need to have your registration in the mail by Saturday the 6th. And we will have concentration, insight, and fun.
What about suffering?
You might have some of that.
The Pali word for fun is anapanawana.
Ah, very good! Way to write that down.
So there is some scholarship money available if you need assistance. The registration flyers are out by the Donna Bowl. All the details are there. I need to run off today, so if you have questions, my contact information is on the bottom of the registration form. Thanks.
Yeah. I'm Larry, and I'm debuting as a host this week. And I'm one of five worker owners in a food business. It's a community kitchen based in Berkeley, and we make traditional nutrient-dense foods. So there are lacto-fermented coolers out there, there's a live cheesecake, and there are coconut sweets, and there is raw milk, and there are peach crisp. So it's very interesting, nice food. If anybody has any questions about it, you can ask me. I hope you enjoy it very much.
Thank you.
I'm Gary, and I'm hosting a potluck for the group today at 6:30 at my house, which is at Church and 18th. So I hope you can all come, or a lot of you. We may not have live cheesecake. I can't promise that, but I sure will be an interesting array. And I have some little flyers I'll pass out to anyone who needs the information.
Next week, instead of a presenting speaker, we have a Damadu, and it's Jerry, Lanyard, and Howard.
Okay.
Any other announcements? Get in a pleasant circle.
Yes,
thank
So I'll just take a moment to ask that we dedicate the good energy in our practice this morning to the monks and nuns and people of Burma, who you may know are almost in a life and death struggle against a very vicious militaristic regime. My teachers, as I mentioned earlier, come from that area and were blessed by the monks and nuns of that area and the lay teachers as well. I wouldn't have these teachings if it wasn't for that. So may the people of Burma be happy. May they be at peace. And may they be liberated. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.